podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Sorry for a bit of a pause in this show. We've just had a few days off, but we're back with you now to preview the one-day series, the Royal London series between England and Australia, of course. It's Simon Hughes here, and Simon Mann is also on the show, of course. And we've got guests. We've got Chris Wokes back in the England one-day side in the white ball team for this series. And also later, we're going to hear from Adam Gilchrist, the legendary Australia wicketkeeper batsman, on his thoughts about the current Australian one-day team. So, Simon, you did the T20s. I mean, what did do you think the two teams learn from the T20s?
I think one thing we learned from the T20s full stop was we really need a crowd. I think they missed a crowd. Just imagine the atmosphere at the Aegeus Bowl last Friday if there had been a full house in watching that Australia capitulation, a remarkable turnaround. I don't know how England won that game, even now, sort of week on.
Here, I'll give you a crowd if you like. There you are. There's a bit of background noise to keep you happy. Go on, carry on.
Well, we need to play that Old Trafford for the next few days. But yeah, no, it was a strange old night. The other thing, I suppose, is how important Owen Morgan is to England's white ball side. When he's out there, there just seems to be a bit of authority in the field and control in the field. Not that England got enough runs in the final one-day international. Owen Morgan not there, of course. He was sitting on the sidelines with his finger injury. As for Australia, I think they've got a few problems to sort out, perhaps in their middle order. And I know Adam Gilchrist is going to speak about that a little later on. What do they do? They've got some gun players in the likes of Smith and Finch and Warner at the top of the order, but they've got some other issues to sort out perhaps in their middle order as well.
They got found out a bit by Adil Rashid in that T20 series. He took 6 wickets, didn't he? And he kept taking key batsmen. I suppose it must be hard for a team that haven't played any cricket really for 6 months or so, or 4 months. So it's been hard for them to adapt, whereas England have been out there. A lot of those players have played some tests and so on. So I suppose it's a little bit easier for England. But Rashid, a key man, wasn't he, in that series, the one day, the T20s. So probably as important in this one-day series to follow, which of course is the first time that England's World Cup winning team has been more or less reunited at home. There was a couple of one-dayers in South Africa, but they were missing players then. So more of the team sort of reassembling now, the World Cup winning team, just missing Stokes and Liam Plunkett, sadly, out of the scene. But Stokes, obviously, just for family reasons, but Plunkett not selected. So I suppose what we should talk about really is whether this England 50-over team can move on. Can they ascend another mountain? And what do they need to do that? Because, you know, often it's said that in sport, it's OK getting to the top, but it's another matter staying at the top. At the moment, England's 50-over side are top of the rankings, number one in the ICC rankings, and Australia are only fifth. But you can see other teams working on their ploys, looking at their strategies, learning from England, and the way they, you know, they're totally fearless, aren't they? That sort of mindset that England have brought into 50-over cricket and adapted some of the T20 skills as well has really sort of put them on a pedestal.
Well, the first challenge for this England one-day side is to qualify for the next World Cup. This is the World Super League that England are going into tomorrow. They've already played some matches against Ireland in that. They won 2 and lost 1. They have to qualify. They have to finish in the top 7. You'd expect them to do that. If they don't do that, then something is going to go seriously wrong during the qualification process. You play a series at home and series away over 3 matches, which is a different dynamic as well. So you don't have these elongated series of 5 matches where, you know, it's possible for teams to lose focus. You're right on it. There's almost knockout matches in their own right. So there's that. And then I suppose they have to find a way to play on Indian pitches, to prepare for Indian pitches, because we've seen England have been so good on shirt fronts, haven't they? What they like is, you know, absolutely blue perfect pitches, flat pitches, which they can smash the ball, put pressure on the opposition, and then their bowlers which is, you know, their bowling attack probably not their strongest suit. Their batting suit is the strongest suit, and then, you know, give their bowlers something to defend. So that's the challenge for them, to adapt to playing on pitches that spin a bit slower. And actually, Owen Morgan has been speaking about this. He said that, you know, playing at Old Trafford and playing at somewhere like Cardiff are the best venues in England to prepare for playing a World Cup in India, albeit that World Cup is 3 years away. But I suppose the white ball players have also got the T20 World Cup next year in India as a goal as well. So there's almost like double preparation for those two events. You know, a lot of World Cup cricket to be played in India in the next 3 years. So that's the challenge for England, is to sort of adapt their style, really, to be able to play on Indian surfaces.
I suppose also, with that in mind, and you talk mainly about batting and the maybe the slight adaption they might need to make to bat on those pitches, but the other thing is bowling on them, and especially bowling spin on them. And Rashid, as we mentioned at the start, not only excelling in the T20s, but also there are rumours and murmurs that he might get the call up to play Test cricket again as well. England likely to play Tests in Sri Lanka and India after Christmas, though we don't know when or exactly where, but they'll be on dryish pitches. And Rashid, you know, is clearly in his prime as a bowler at the moment. But, you know, who could support him in those environments in one day cricket? They haven't got a Don Bess, really. They haven't pitched him into the 50 over yet. Obviously, Moeen Ali is sort of in residence, but he's not bowled that much in T20. I mean, maybe they will use him in the 50 over, but he didn't play in the last few matches of the World Cup. So, you know, England might need to look at blooding another spinner in this 50 over team to really have a very strong suit of bowlers to plan the next couple of years. I suppose with Archer reunited with Chris Wokes at the top of the bowling order, that does give England, you know, a lot of potential wicket taking there. Wokes obviously very good with the new ball in English conditions especially, and Archer got all the kind of capabilities and speed. So with him and Mark Wood, you know, that does look like a good three-pronged attack. Of course, Chris Wokes hasn't played much white ball cricket really for quite a long time. He's been in the Test team playing red ball, but no white ball experience. He didn't play in the T20s just the other day or against Pakistan. So I asked him, you know, what is the difference between bowling with the white ball and the red ball, especially if you haven't done much of it recently?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the balls are different, which some people might find hard to grasp. Like, how can a ball be so different to bowl with? But they do react differently out your hand. You know, obviously the red ball, particularly the red Duke's swings, you know, don't generally get a bit of movement in the air and off the seam occasionally. Whereas a white ball, they tend not to do much as, you know, or certainly don't do as much for as long. You might get a bit of swing with the new ball potentially for an over. But after that, they generally go pretty straight. So therefore, you know, what you're trying to deliver as a bowler, you know, changes compared to what you do with a red ball. You're trying to, you know, hit the wicket as hard as possible. Use your variations, which, as we touched on, you don't tend to do in Test cricket. So, yeah, the balls do change. And it's more a mindset, I suppose, of what the batsman's trying to do as well. You know, he's trying to be a lot more aggressive, trying to hit you for fours and sixes, whereas, you know, in Test cricket, you're challenging people's defence and trying to outlast the opposition a little bit. Whereas, you know, the white ball stuff, it all moves forward a bit quicker.
Is it actually, in a way, almost, you said there about mindset, is it almost that in Test cricket, you as the bowler are the attacker, whereas in one day white ball cricket, you as the bowler are the defender?
Yeah, in a way, yeah. I think you try to get away from that mindset, I think, because you still want to be able to attack and try and take wickets. And, you know, the best way to defend in white ball cricket is by taking wickets and attacking, so to speak. So the better you can attack and get wickets early on, the easier it is to defend runs. So it's a tricky one, because you do have a little bit in the back of your mind of damage limitation in white ball cricket. As a bowler, but then you also know that wickets are the best way of saving runs. So it's getting that balance right, which can be tricky.
You had nearly, 2 months in lockdown playing at those two venues in Test cricket. So you were unable to see your family. So when you finally got home after that stint, what was the first thing that you did other than, you know, obviously hugging your nearest and dearest and kids and stuff? What was the first thing that you did when you got home?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You're away from home for such a long period of time, and I'm sure you had this whilst you were away touring and things like this, but got home and, you know, first thing that was on the list was to do some chores, cut the grass, get that done. It was about this long. So yeah, I mean, other than that, it was great to get home and see family and friends, obviously having been away for such a long period of time. And just had a very weird feel to it, I suppose, because, you know, we're used to touring and being away from home. That's kind of, you know, the norm for us cricketers, but being away for such a long and extended period whilst in this country and in the environment that we've been in, just felt, you know, that little bit weird and a bit different, as it has been for everyone. But you know, really nice to get home and come crashing back down to earth, I suppose.
who was the best and worst companion in lockdown?
Well, it's an easy question, an easy answer, should I say, because the best person to be around is Mark Wood, and then the worst person to be around is Mark Wood. So it's, you know, little snippets of Woody during that time was fantastic, but too much of him was way too much. So, yeah, that was pretty easy. But we've got a good group. Everyone gets on really well. You know, and you suppose you learn a few different things about people when you're with them so often. But, you know, I think we've got a good group where we kind of respect each other's privacy. And, you know, if a guy needs a bit of time away, you know, you give them that space. And, you know, the environment that we've got within the team is very good, and everyone gets on well. So, you know, I suppose when you're in, you know, supposedly a house or a hotel for such a long period of time, that does help.
Quite funny, actually, that Mark Wood is both your best and worst companion when you're in the bio bubble, but he does sort of add something, doesn't he? He's certainly on the field, and you can feel it probably off the field as well. He just gets that sort of energy levels up and enthusiasm, and I'm sure there's never a dull moment with Mark Wood around. And his pace as well. You know, that he was again notching sort of 95 miles an hour in the T20s, wasn't he?
Yeah, there was some extreme pace, and he helped England to win the series. It's amazing, though, when you watch someone like Wood bowl, if you get it a bit wrong, as he did in that over that yielded 14 that helped Australia win on Tuesday, if you get it a bit wrong, you just get absolutely smashed. The quality of batting against anything that's just slightly offline or length is just so high. Marcus Stoinis hitting him over deep mid wicket or wide long on him is well in front of square for six, and then a ball is just wide of off stump, crashing him through the offside for four as well. It's incredible, isn't it? You can have pace, but if you've got to harness it with that accuracy and skill as well. Because if you don't, these batsmen are good enough to just hit you everywhere.
What about Joe Root? He's back in the side now. So, again, didn't play in the T20s, but very much likely to be number three for England in these 3 one-day matches. And actually, I asked Marcus Roscothick the other day about Joe Root and whether he thought there was still a role, given the incredible advance of, you know, breathtaking batting in T20 especially, and the way that England go about the innings with Jason Roy and Johnny Bairstow opening the batting in 50-over cricket as well. I asked him if he thought Joe Root still had a role, or a batsman like Joe Root still had a role in 50-over, and he said, absolutely, you still need, in that longer format, you still need someone to knock it around, to be that stabilising influence, maybe to rebuild if there's an early wicket or two, and to actually, you know, especially on bigger grounds, some of the grounds in somewhere like Australia or even maybe in India, if they're bigger boundaries, say Calcutta, somewhere like that, knocking it into gaps and working the ball around against spin as well, where the ball's turning a bit, is an invaluable art.
Well, Root, of course, played in England's World T20 side in 2016. He played in the final. He actually took a couple of wickets in his first over. So his bowling is useful as well. His one-day record for England is fantastic. He averages over 50, strike rate of nearly 88, and he scored 1600s. He's played 146 games. He's absolutely vital for England's 50-over chances. And you know what he does as well is he's so good at rotating the strike. You know, he's so good at scoring, you know, close to a runner ball and ticking the board over. And he's, you know, he's that counterpoint to England's, you know, aggressive top order players. I wouldn't totally back against him coming back for the World Cup and the World T20 next year. I mean, the way England seem to be moving away from him a bit in T20 cricket, but I think they know they've sort of got him in the locker in case they need to go back to him. But at the moment, someone like David Malan has been taking his chance. You know, it's hard to leave him out of the side, although how they fit them all in when they're all available again. I'm thinking of, you know, Jason Roy, who's back in this one-day side, but of course didn't play in the T20 series. You know, how do you fit them all in? Jason Roy and, you know, Ben Stokes to come back as well. You know, everyone says it's a good problem, but someone's got to solve it somehow. It's not an easy one to sort out. I suppose in the end, you just have to be ruthless, don't you? And possibly even, you know, you even mix and match a bit, perhaps depending on the surface you're playing on. I mean, you know, we've been to India many times, and you think, you know, India being sort of Indian pitches, but they're not all the same. You know, the Mohali and Bangalore, say, you know, are quite different from, you know, some of the other surfaces in India, say, I don't know, Mumbai, somewhere like that. You know, Bangalore is a bit there for the seamers often, and say Mohali, it bounces a bit more and comes on nicely, whereas, you know, other grounds, the ball is, you know, is a bit slower and lower, and then it depends on how old the pitches are as well, whether it's a used pitch. So, you know, it's not all just Indian pitches are all the same.
Yeah, true. Just looking ahead to this series, the 3-1 days against Australia, not quite the one-day side of old, I feel. If you think back to those teams that won the World Cup three times in a row, dominated by your Pontings and Gilchrist and Warne and McGrath and so on, they did have every base covered. Whereas this side, you sort of feel a little bit vulnerable. A good top order batsman, obviously Finch and Warner, Steve Smith, we all know about. The middle order hasn't quite really cemented its position, hasn't quite established itself. They're not quite sure. There's a sort of Glenn Maxwell, who's a bit of an enigma, and there's Marcus Stoinis, who can come off, but seems maybe a bit limited. He's not great against spin. So do you think, I mean, whereas England have got, you know, Butler, who will probably bat at six, who's so adaptable and so dangerous, is that the area, do you think, that Australia are weak?
Yeah, and Butler might well bat at five in this one-day series. Just depends. No Ben Stokes in the side. Well, yeah, that, I think that's what they're concerned about. They're concerned about the middle order. They're concerned about their batting against spin bowling. There is, of course, one player who has not played so far, who's in the sort of international infancy in terms of one-day international cricket, and that's Manus Labuschagne. He's only played 7 one-day internationals. We saw how good he's been in red ball cricket in the last year or so. Very good Ashes and then a brilliant winter in Australia. He's only played 7 one-day internationals, but he's already served notice. He's averaging 50 and his strike rate is 94. So that will be the one, you know, thing to focus on in the next few days, to see how he goes in one-day international cricket, because, you know, that is someone that they can use and they can, you know, allow to flourish in their middle order. So, you know, that is a potential solution for him. We saw how good he was, and he's such a, you know, he's a cricket badger, isn't
cricket
he?
Badger,
you know,
for sure.
He's another one. You know, he's another one.
He's a Smith clone, isn't he?
Yeah, I always feel with this Australia one day side, I feel with this current Australia one day side that those top two, a bit like England in a way, that, you know, they're so dynamic at the top, but Warner and Finch are so important to them. If you get Warner early, you can do so much damage. You get Warner early, an early wicket or two, it really sets this Australian side back. We did see it in the 2020 when Warner was out for naught, and of course the World Cup semi-final, England got Warner early in that match as well, and it had just had that debilitating effect on Australia, despite the fact that Steve Smith got runs. You really feel Warner is a player that can dominate you and bully you, and he bullies you not just with his aggressive batting, but also with his running between the wickets as well. Yeah. It's interesting on Warner, talking about, you know, playing in the bubble. His comments, you know, a few weeks ago, and he talked about them again in Southampton, about whether he's prepared to, you know, go on play, you know, if the coronavirus is still around for a long time and cricket has to be played in these bio bubbles, you know, whether he's, you know, really committed to go on playing for Australia, playing international cricket, because his family is so important to him, and it's not easy to get the families into the bubbles. I think for the IPL, when Morgan was talking about this morning, he was asked about it, you know, what's going to be different, you know, these sort of weeks, months of being in the bubble. He said, well, at least in the UAE, the hotels they'll be staying at. You know, I think the KKR staying at a hotel, you know, with a beach and a pool, and families will be allowed in the bubble. So that is a, you know, a bonus for IPL players, but not necessarily that luxury for international players, depending where you are in the world. Certainly not in this country. I mean, no beach at Old Trafford, for example, no swimming pool at Old Trafford, and no families as well.
I'm not sure you'd want a beach at Old Trafford, actually, because you'd have to have an umbrella up all the time when you were on it, wouldn't you? Just looking at the Australia setup, it was interesting to listen to Adam Gilchrist talking about it, because, of course, he was an absolute groundbreaker. In the late 90s, he was scoring at 96 runs per 100 balls, which was much quicker than most people. And 17 one-day hundreds, a stack of runs against all countries, numerous World Cup medals, an incredible player at the top of the order. And I think from talking to him, I got the sense that he felt that there was something just not quite right about this Australian batting order.
Is it perhaps the middle order, that lower middle order? Is that a problem area, do you think?
Yeah, Simon, I think it was clearly shown again in the T20 format, and it's been a little bit of a handbrake or a hurdle for the Australians in the one-day sort of format for a number of years as well. Those middle overs, particularly against the spinning ball. And, you know, not only does the run rate come down, they tend to lose wickets and tend to lose them in clumps too. And we saw that obviously with the collapse in that first game. That was, I guess, just pressure, perhaps rustiness from 6 months out of the game and rushing over there and all the unique situations that all cricketers find themselves in at the moment. But, I think that's probably the area where other teams have tended to be really accelerating and starting to play a more aggressive brand or style of cricket, if you like, with the bat in hand through those middle overs. That's been our Achilles heel for a number of years. So that will be challenging again, obviously, with the makeup of the England bowling lineup and how everyone in world cricket is probably aware of that handbrake for Australia there. So I don't think anything's going to be different by way of approach from the English towards that batting lineup for the Australians. It's all on the Aussies to work out what the psychology will be, what the match plan will be, and what the makeup of the batting order will be. I just think, as a general rule, it is that they're very much caught between the consolidation period, not trying to lose wickets, but also just how hard they can go. I guess the other thing too is that at the top of the order, David Warner has been so successful, but as opposed to people relate to David Warner being so aggressive at the top of the order and you know, a shot a minute. But I think that's been more in his test cricket earlier on in his career. His one-day cricket and his one-day centuries have more so been a little bit more calculated and a little bit more tailored to building up as he goes along and not so fiery at the top of the order. Does that create then a little bit in this modern way of playing and these scores of 300, 350, is that sort of a bit too old school for what is going on now when you compare it to, you know, the likes of Bairstow at the top, you know, and the way he just goes out, and Jason Roy and so on, and Joss in the T20s.
So in a way, it's the pressure, perhaps, of lack of the real fast scoring rate at the top that puts the emphasis on that middle order to you know, up the ante. And, you know, who's the solution to that? I mean, Glenn Maxwell is a bit of an enigma. Marcus Stoinis has had a tremendous big bash, but is he the guy in the middle overs? Because he's not a great manipulator of the ball. So who's the solution to that kind of area?
Well, I reckon a guy that in time could very well be the solution, whether it's going out at number one or two or even getting a chance in that middle order, is Josh Phillippe. And I think
I knew you'd say that. Yeah.
Yeah.
A co-Perthite.
Yeah, that's right. Born and bred in Perth and know his dad very well, who worked at the Wacker for well over 20 years. But a very exciting young talent. Still learning his craft. He's still learning about himself and what his capabilities are and of course, match situations. But the quicker you can get them exposed to the top level with that uninhibited sort of approach, and he can maybe capture a few teams off guard, that's only going to fulfill his or instill more confidence in him to not suddenly have to think he's got to rein it in because he's at the next level. Some talent.
He's a right-handed version of you, isn't he?
Oh, I don't know. He goes pretty hard at it. Yeah, slogger, if that's what you're calling him. Yeah, but he's just a really aggressive young kid. And just observing, you know, what took England to the number one position, what had them consistently in number one in the 4 years leading up to that World Cup victory was just, clearly you guys all know it better than me, but just that change in mindset from the captaincy to the approach of batting, the way that they want to just attack, and you're going to have your train wrecks occasionally, but just as a general statement, a fraction conservative, that Aussie batting lineup, and a guy like Phillippe could be a catalyst for change.
Well, that's Adam Gilchrist, who, of course, would walk into an all-time combined England-Australia 50-over side. Who else walks into that 50-over side? You've been debating this in the last couple of days, haven't you? I mean, Gilchrist was part of that debate, and Marcus Trescothick as well. Didn't Marcus Trescothick get into the 11? And David Warner didn't?
I'm not quite sure about that. Yeah, true. I mean, so this was a little event put on by Royal London, the sponsors of the 3 one-day matches, and they were debating, you know, who to put in the combined all-time one-day 11. They obligingly picked each other, which of course you do in these situations. So the opening pair, Trescothick and Gilchrist, pretty good, I have to say. I mean, that's sort of over 30 one-day international hundreds and, you know, a phenomenal record and very dangerous at the top of the order. The great thing about Trescothick, actually, was he just did it naturally. He didn't play really any differently in 50 over than he did in tests. He saw the ball, he smacked it for four. Very simple method and very successful. Warner's record is slightly better, I suppose, but I don't know, I just quite like Trescothick's almost sort of lugubrious style, and he's just a very good team man. He's just someone you want in your team. He's very reliable, I think, and in quite an explosive way. So I'd have him with Gilchrist, I'm afraid, ahead of Warner.
Would you? What about Bairstow as well? Bairstow and Warner are good contenders. And Bairstow's still playing, of course. He's helped England win a World Cup. He's played 80 one-day matches. He's already scored 900. His strike rate better than Trescothick. It's not easy to compare eras. Also, that's the other thing as well. It's about styles that England have decided to play in a particular way,
sort of belligerent,
in the last
way.
4 years. Yeah, and so that's, you know, they've changed the game in a way. They've taken it to another level, or taken their game to another level. And if perhaps, you know, Marcus Trescothick was a wonderful player to watch in one day cricket. But if he was encouraged to play in an even more expansive way, you know, who knows what his stats figures would have been. You know, it's not easy comparing eras. It's not easy, I think, because this England one day side of the last 4 years, I mean, such an outlier compared to what came before it. You know, basically there was before 2016 and after 2016. Whereas with Australia, it's not quite the same because they've had quality for quite a long time now. And you think of, I mean, I think someone like Smith and Warner would have been magnificent players. Of course, they would have been in that, you know, great Australian side, and they'd have been vying for their place in that, you know, great Australian side that won World Cups, because they are absolutely top class players. And without them, and we saw it in the last year, I think without them, you know, while they were banned, you know, Australia, they were not the same team. I mean, they clearly not. They're magnificent players.
So the lineup we came up with in the end, and obviously you can argue about this, Simon and the listeners, but the lineup we came up with was Trescothick and Gilchrist, Ponting at 3, Peterson 4, Morgan at 5, Stokes 6, Butler 7, Warne 8, and then 3 bowlers, McGrath, Gough, and Mitchell Starc. So not too many of the current Australian team in that side, only really Mitchell Starc, but several of the current England side in it.
Well, they're great pub debates, aren't they? You know, who makes various 11s? You can make cases for all sorts of players. You could even make out a place for Rashid if you wanted a bit of extra spin. I mean, not ahead of Shane Warne, obviously, but that side seems quite pace orientated. Again, it depends where you're going to play, but I mean, you could actually put together a decent 11 to play against them. I mean, there are players like Best, who just mentioned him, Gooch, Mark Waugh, Steve Waugh. Steve Waugh played in 325 one-day internationals and scored 7,500 runs. Yeah, his average was only 32. Of course, he was coming in lower down the order, and his strike rate was 75. But he also took 195 wickets as well. So, you know, that's an all-round package.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point to mention him, because he was an underrated one-day player. And I remember that from sort of personal hardship, actually, trying to bowl at the death in a one-day game for Middlesex against Somerset in his early years. And he was impossible to contain. I think it's the hardest person I've ever had to bowl at in a one-day format, actually, because he just moved around the crease and with effortless ease, he put everything away for four. And there were some good balls in there. There were some almost inch-perfect Yorkers, which he managed to get sort of outside off stump and kind of shovel for four through square leg. He wasn't an innovator particularly, but he was just incredibly effective and just had that, you know, totally clenched jaw, gimlet-eyed determination to find a way to score. And it was relentless. And he did that in, well, at least two World Cups, didn't he?
Yeah. Winners in 1999, that famous victory when he was, well, batting at Headingley and the supposedly Herschel Gibbs dropping the World Cup and Australia going on to the final after that tied semi-final. I don't know, Craig McDermott, 203 one-day wickets in 138 matches. These are just players off the top of my head, really. I haven't sat down and thought carefully about...
Matthew Hayden, I suppose we should mention
him
too.
Well, yeah, absolutely Matthew Hayden, yeah. No doubt about it.
A bully at the top of the order.
Yeah, and they had such a strong side, Australia. This side, I think it's still pretty good. They are one of the challengers. I mean, they got to the semi-final of the World Cup last year. I mean, Hayden, 161 one-day internationals, over 6,000 runs, strike rate of 78 ten hundreds. I mean, you look at strike rates now and they've gone up, haven't they? And that's the thing. It's about the era in which you play, and it's about the context of the game and how you see your side overall against the opposition as well, and what you feel is enough to win a match. There's no doubt in that. And, you know, regulations change as well. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
The fielding restrictions, they change over time. They go one way and then the other. So there's all sorts of things to feed into that.
And I suppose the other thing is that team, that Australian team, played a huge number of matches. They had all those tri-series in Australia and they went on tour, and obviously they played right to the death in many World Cups. So, you know, they played more games. You look at, say, Gilchrist, who played nearly 300 one-day internationals, and, you know, Ricky Ponting played, I think, 400. So England's players are still playing catch-up to that number, that quantity, that, you know, depth of experience. But certainly over the last two or three years, England have focused more on that amount of games, getting lots of games under their belt and staying with the same group of players as well. And probably that's been an instrumental part in why they've become so good, because they're trusting each other. They've worked in lots of different environments together. They've seen lots of scenarios together and been able to perform well and win the matches in different situations.
Yeah, that's going to change a bit now, though, isn't it? Because the series they're going to play are three-match series as part of the World Super League qualifying for the World Cup. It's all been rationalised. So gone are the seven-match one-day series. I've been to India, and I'm sure that I've worked on at least two seven-match one-day series.
And they're a grind, aren't they? I mean, they're tough, because I know we shouldn't be saying that, because it's a pleasure to be able to go and commentate on cricket wherever it is, but in a way, those games, those series are hard, because you do the game, finishes at kind of midnight, you get back to the hotel, then you're on a plane at 9 a.m. to some other place, and you're getting there late afternoon, training the next day, another game, and then another trip somewhere. So they are pretty demanding, aren't they, those trips?
Yeah, it's not like it's not like playing Lords one day and then the Oval the next match. You know, you've normally got a 1-2 hour plane journey plus all that, you know, all that around it as well. So that's gone now.
Do you remember that game we covered once at that World Cup game we covered in Bangladesh, where we had to get there from Bangalore, and we had to go Bangalore, Calcutta, and then there's no direct flight, internal flight from Calcutta to Dhaka, even though it's only about 25 miles or something. So you have to go from the domestic to the international terminal, and then hop over to Dhaka with about a 4-hour delay in the flight.
Yeah.
So, you know, a trip which probably should take, if it was as the crow flies, direct flight, probably take 2 hours or 2.5 hours, takes about 12 hours. And then we got there and the game lasted... It was West Indies Bangladesh, wasn't it? West Indies bowled Bangladesh out for 50 odd, knocked off the runs in about 6 overs. And then we were on the plane back.
Well, you say we were on the plane back. Someone cancelled my flight back.
We wanted to leave you there, you see.
Yeah, the other thing about that match was the lines didn't work as well. So we
were commentating on an iPad.
Our producer, Tim Peach, had sort of put something together that he'd never done before. I think actually in the end, we were quite relieved that Bangladesh were all out for about 50 or 60, because it was quite an arduous experience. And well, the whole package, really, of getting there and then trying to get out of the country as well.
Isn't it funny? It just shows how broadcasting's changed, isn't it? Because, you know, 2011, there we are thinking how weird it was, commentating on a phone or an iPad or something. Yeah. And now we're doing it right now. We're commentating online, you know, remotely. So it shows how the world has adapted really well, the broadcasting world.
Yeah. Yeah. Things have changed enormously. Well, my first ever World Cup in India back in 1996, you know, you'd have something called a four wire, and you'd be the day before a game, you'd be plugged in from whatever your venue is into Delhi, and then hopefully the next day someone in Delhi would plug you through to someone in London. It was, you know, a laborious process. But these days, you know, you just
dial them up,
you're straight through. Anyway, that's sort of like all our yesterdays. The world moves on technologically. I think we've seen that in the last few months with Zoom, and you know, everyone's now working at home. We realized what's possible thanks to the internet revolution. So who are you backing to win this one-day series then? We've established that it does matter. It's not, you know, fixed your fulfillment right at the fag end of the season. You know, it's part of the World Super League, so qualification points, the World Cup on offer, 10 points for a win. Are England clearly favourites, or is this Australia side good enough to really challenge them? As of course they did in the World Cup last year, they beat them at Lord's, but then lost very heavily to them at Edgbaston in the World Cup semi-final.
Yeah, I mean, I think England are favourites. You know, they're at home. They've played a lot more cricket than the Aussies have recently. They've got a more stable setup. They know how each other play. They're without Stokes, obviously. They're missing a key man, but I think apart from that, they're pretty much at full strength. I mean, they've sort of replaced Liam Plunkett with a Tom Curran or someone like that. So I think that England are more secure in how they play. Australia is slightly more unknown, especially that middle order. I'm disappointed with someone like Glenn Maxwell that he can't quite deliver. He's got the talent of Joss Butler, but he hasn't got the consistency. And if he could find that way of delivering more often, under pressure especially, I think that would be a big turning point, because he's actually a very effective bowler as well. He's a good limited overs bowler and a brilliant fielder. But he hasn't ever quite really cemented his place. And, you know, apart from him, Labuschagne comes in to sort of bolster that middle order. Stoinis is a dangerous player, you know. I don't feel Ashton Agar is a solution at number 7. I think he's a weak link. You know, he's got a best score in T20s of 29 or something. So, you know, I can't see him really being a force in white ball cricket at number 7. So they need to find somebody in that spot. Obviously, Finch and Warner, top players. Smith hasn't yet fired in this short series, but maybe he will at Old Trafford. It's going to be tight games, but I just think England, with the X factor of Butler, with Archer and Wood's pace, with Rashid, you know, and his clever variations, and obviously their strength of power at the top of the order, I just think England are...
I think in these short-form series, they're notoriously hard to predict. But England at home, I think 2-1, similar to the T20 series. But, you know, it should be a really riveting series. Australia have got the quality. I think a lot depends on, you know, Warner and Finch at the top, Smith, perhaps Labuschagne, and then what Australia's gun pace bowlers can do as well, if they can just limit this England batting lineup. Jason Roy coming back into the side. He's not played a lot. There's a potential opportunity there for Australia at the top of the order to make early inroads, especially because their bowling is so good. You know, we saw it in the T20 series, you know, the likes of Hazelwood and Stark and Cummins, you know, they've got quality bowling in that lineup. So they're test match bowlers, but you know, they're very good at the top of the order. They can knock over some early England wickets, and there's no Ben Stokes. You know, I think it's quite an even series, actually. It's hard to separate them. Possibly England 2-1, but it wouldn't surprise me if Australia got up 2-1 as well.
Oh, you fence sitter, you. Well, anyway, the key thing is going to be how the analysts do. And I don't mean me, I mean the two team analysts, because data and statistics and matchups are all the rage in one-day cricket and all forms of cricket now. And that's why this current issue of the Cricketer magazine has the title The Data Decade. And we look at how the game is covered and how it's analysed and how it's scrutinised in so many different ways now, not just with wordsmiths crafting beautiful prose. So on next week's show, as an echo to this current issue of the Cricketer magazine, which you can get at www.thecricketer.com. There's a special offer there at the moment. We're going to interview next week two people from the same family who cover the game in totally different ways. And they'll have had a lot, I'm sure, to write about over this weekend with these three one-day matches. I hope you enjoyed them, and we'll speak to you after the last of those games early next week. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.